He starts with story in Genesis and he ends with story in Revelation. There's just lots of stories in between. What was Jesus known as? A storyteller. There are parts of the Bible that are not story, but there's an awful lot of story. So it must be important. So I would like to start with a story. This really and truly happened. I didn't make this up. But the map that you see on the board over here represents where I grew up as a boy. And this happened after I left home. And so my family told me about this. My mother likes to go fishing. And so one day, she lives in this house right here. She walked down the road, and right nearby the road down here is the Conedogwinet Creek in Cumberland County, Pennsylvania. Somewhere along this bank, she began to clear some weeds so she could throw her fishing line into the water. It so happened it was in the spring of the year, and so the water was full. The creek banks were full. And she looked up from her preparation, and she saw a mortar tub floating down the creek. And there was a man in the mortar tub. And so she said, "Hello." And he said, "Hello." She went about preparing her place for fishing. Not very long later, she looked up, and here's this man coming toward her up the bank. The river, the creek flows this direction. He was walking like this up to her. And he said to her, "Do you know where I could get some food?" And she says, "Well, I can go ask my husband. We just live up here in this house." She pointed up the house. It's very easy to see. And in the course of conversation, she said, "How do I know you're not going to hurt me?" And he said, "Well, I'd rather help you than harm you. So come on up." So they went up to the house, talked to my dad, and my parents decided that, well, maybe he needs more than just food. Maybe we can host him. So they had a place in the basement. So they were going to allow him to stay in the basement, and he was going to work on the farm. But my dad noticed he needed some shoes. So the next day they went to Carlisle and bought him a $54 pair of shoes. I'm not sure which day of the week that was, but there was something about this man that by Saturday night some of the family's feeling uneasy about. In the process of studying their Sunday school lesson on Saturday night, this man asked my dad, "Can a person be forgiven if he kills somebody?" "Yeah, if you repent." And so the next morning, they took this man along to church. And during the church service, he needed to go outside and smoke, but he came back in. And after the service, they went to visit my aunt, and he went along. He didn't actually go in the house. He just stayed outside. But by Monday morning, the deacon of the church is putting two and two together in his mind. He remembered seeing a newspaper composite drawing of a killer that had committed a crime in Franklin County. There were two women that were shot on the Appalachian Trail, one killed and the other was just wounded. And he's wondering, I wonder if this is the man. And so he called Carlisle, which is the county seat, and he says, "I think I know where this man is." And so Cumberland County calls out the Franklin County. In fact, I have this backwards, I see. Calls out the Franklin County, which is far to the west out here. And they left them know that they think they have their man. And Franklin County did not want to believe that because they wanted the, quote, fun of apprehending this man. But the more he talked, the more they realized this is probably the case. So they told this deacon in the church, "You're staying right here. And you're a farmer. Do you have a cattle truck?" "Yes." "Get it here." "Why?" "We're going to have a SWAT team storm Chester Weaver's house to get him." And now the deacon's thinking, "Oh no, what am I doing?" Deacons are supposed to serve their people, not arrange for SWAT teams to storm the house. But now things are out of his control. And so my dad knows nothing of what's going on. And as soon as the authorities realize what's up, they immediately, without wasting any time, start to lay plans how they're going to get this man. And so they're surrounding the farm with policemen. My dad knows nothing about this. My dad is planning to go to a chiropractor appointment. But before he goes out with this man out behind the barn over here, and he starts pointing out some things, and not knowing that there's a policeman watching with binoculars. And the policeman calls into Carlisle and says, "What's this Chester Weaver like? Is he dependable?" So the deacon is still there. "Yeah, he's dependable." The policeman thought that my dad was pointing out the police car that was sitting over here along this road. So plans continued. And after he got that finished, my dad got in his car. He just goes driving down the road. He got down below this farm right here, and he came to a policeman that stopped him. And the policeman says, "Open your trunk." So my dad gets out, opens his trunk. "What's up?" "Well, is there such and such a man living at your place?" "Yeah." "Well, we're just about ready to get him. We're going to storm the house and get him." And my dad says, "Oh, no, don't get too hasty here." He says, "You don't have to storm the house, because just in a few minutes, I have a son who's going to be bringing some cattle from this farm down the road to this farm. So you don't have to storm the house. You can get him out in the open." "Okay, well, you're staying right here. It doesn't matter anything about your chiropractor appointment. You're staying right here." And so, by this time, at this farm, there are policemen in the garages, in the barn, everything. There's all kinds of policemen around here. And so this policeman who stopped my dad down the road says, "Hold up, get all those police cars hidden. We can get him in the open." So they do all that. My brother gets in the truck with this man. His name is Steve Carr. That's his real name. And they go driving down the road, not knowing anything. And as my brother drives his truck into this farm, my other brother, Curtis, comes walking out of the house while Steve Carr gets out of a truck to go down and open a gate. And my brother says to my youngest brother who's driving the truck, "They're going to get him." So as this man comes walking down to open up this gate, the policemen storm out of the milk house with guns on him. "Lay down, lay down." Of course, he laid down right away. He wasn't armed. When he was on the ground, my brother walked up to him and says, "We did not report you." Because along the way, they realized this is a criminal. But they had told him, "We're not going to report him." Okay. They had him. They took him to prison. The people in the church tried to relate to him. But this is one of those boys who didn't have any love. And he was a hard man. And he wouldn't let people come into his life. He just kind of kept them at bay like this. But the next day, after this happened, of course, the media are all around taking pictures and doing all their media stuff where this all happened. The neighbors responded to this. The question was whether my dad did something right, wrong, or was it neutral. So I want you folks to close your eyes. Close your eyes. This is not a trick. You're okay. There's no criminals here. Okay? How many of you think my dad did right with that? Put your hands up. Okay? How many of you think my dad did wrong? How many of you don't know? Okay. Thank you. Well, you may open your eyes now. I told the very same story on Tuesday, asked the very same questions, and this group feels differently about it than the first group on Tuesday. We had many more people on Tuesday who didn't think my dad did right. Okay, some people thought that my dad was a fool for taking somebody like that into his house. That was crazy. You don't deal with people like that. Other people, and most people, thought he did do right. And for this group right here, most of you also thought he did right. Okay? Now, I'm going to be just leaving that story for now. I'm going to go on and talk about some things. I may come back to this story a little bit. On your handout, you'll notice that there's a few of you here need some. Who needs a handout? Here, yes. Pass this over. You'll notice the class objectives, and then below that it says, why is story so powerful? I noticed when I was telling that story that every single one of you was listening. Every single one of you. Sometimes I like to sit back and watch speakers, just evaluate their speaking and their teaching. And you'll notice with me that anytime somebody tells a story, everybody's listening. But when a person's just explaining something, they may be talking to their neighbor, they're getting something out of their purse, they're blowing their nose, they're looking around, looking at their watches. But when it comes to story, everybody is right there. Why is story so powerful? Number one, like your paper says, it communicates well. It's clear. That's why it communicates well. We immediately connect. Why? Look at number two. We naturally think in the concrete, not the abstract. How many of you believe that innocence is its own defense? Raise your hand. Innocence is its own defense. Okay? How many of you have ever read a piece of string? The story by Maupassant, A Piece of String. That's what that story teaches. I could stand up here and talk to you for 3/4 of an hour trying to convince you that innocence is its own defense. I could get you to read that story in 15 minutes and you'd be more powerfully convinced than if I explained it to you. That's the power of story. Because our minds are made so that we connect with the concrete. And when you try to explain abstract, you've got to always connect it with the concrete. That's one of the reasons why story is so powerful. Thirdly, we're naturally attracted to movement, to action, to conversation. You all know Abraham Lincoln, don't you? You know who I mean? You know him as a rail splitter. He was a president. Who was his wife? Mary Todd. Do you know much about her? Okay, look at this. I found this book some time ago. This is a real true book. It says, Lincoln's Unknown Private Life. Here's Lincoln. Here's Mary Todd. And here is the black domestic who lived with the Lincolns. Or no, she came in to do the laundry for the Lincolns. And inside the fly cover it says, discovery of the recorded oral history of Maria Vance, who's the black lady here, who worked in the Lincoln home from 1850 to 1860, is being heralded as America's Dead Sea Scroll. The find has great historical significance. The Library of Congress estimates that 5,036 books have been written about Abraham Lincoln, yet very little is known about his private family life. Now, for the first time, an eyewitness answers the most controversial questions about Mary Todd Lincoln's drug addiction, her rages, the Anne Rutledge romance, and more. How these reminiscences came to light after 135 years is itself a remarkable story. Mariah, a religious, warm-hearted woman who could neither read nor write, was laundress, cook, and then housekeeper to the Lincolns from 1850 until he was elected president in 1860. When Lincoln's family prepared to move to Washington, Mariah and her large family moved to Danville, Illinois. For 40 years, Mariah told stories about the Lincolns to anyone who would listen. In 1900, Mariah, a widow in her 80s, was still supporting herself as a laundress. Now, this is what I just love this. If you are ever in a situation, you realize you're like this, capture the moment. When Ada Sutton, a 17-year-old secretary, used Mariah's services and heard the Lincoln stories, she wrote them down shorthand. The note-taking continued until Mariah died in 1904. 1904 is the year my grandpa was born. Now, the back half of this book is the actual writing that she wrote while Mariah was telling. The first part is the stories. And I'm going to take a little bit of time to read you one of these stories. Lots and lots of books have been written about Abraham Lincoln. See if this is how you would have understood the Lincolns. This is April 1850, and the title of this is Getting Acquainted with the Missy. Now, I'm not going to read every single word I have here because there's some words that this lady uses that it's just better if I don't say. The preface to this story says, one day while his father is away on the circuit, that's the lawyer circuit, Robert, which is Abe Lincoln's oldest son, runs anxiously to Mariah's house and pleads with her to come quickly. His mother needs help. At the time, Mary Lincoln is with child. The week of my first wash day at Mr. Abe's hadn't passed when one afternoon about four, I sees a boy chase an owl out of wind right in on our front yard. Flashes of lightning and weak thunder was coming down out of the sky. It was that poor, spunky Master Robert calling out, Mrs. Vance, come quick. My ma was in torment. I got him quiet in a spell. What you mean your ma was in torment? Though I just want to say she's just getting her just dues from God. But sure as there's a God in heaven, when I looked at that poor scared baby boy, I say to myself, quit your infernal evil, devil thinking, and gentle down. Then I say, what's ailing your ma? Oh, Mrs. Vance, do come. Master Robert say, I've asked everyone I know and no good. No one wants to help her. One woman says to me, let her die and go to hell. They hate her. They hate her and they hate me. She's afraid of this thunder and lightning. She's got her head covered screaming for help. Paul's gone and I'm all ma has. You heard Paul say so. My Henry sitting there says, Mariah, think it's how you better go. I'm on de brats for a spell. Master Robert's eyes done lit up like one of those newfangled oil lamps. Then he spied our Billy. That was Mariah's son. Billy was about the size of Master Robert. They took each other about as how two monkeys in a coconut tree. Master Robert forgot he was in a shake to help his ma. But I did no fiddling. I wants to get along, get back before the storm broke. Not a thing would gentle those boys down. So I say, Master Robert, should I take Billy along in the cart with us? He was so pleasured, he had an attack of chuckles right off, right there. And then I knows my black Billy and that blessed white Master Robert was going to be everlasting fast friends. We loaded ourselves in the cart, and you should have saw how away that mule Maud shoved along with each clap of thunder. The boys yelled and laughed with heaps of spirit. The thunder got louder and the mule got faster. I sure believe Master Robert was more joyful than he'd ever been before in his unhappy little lonesome-like life. About halfway there, we'd gone about three or four blocks, and out jumps a pack of rascals to try to stop that mule. You'd never know what that fool mule was about to do until she'd done it. She pushed right smack through that mob, and did they scamper a spell. Then they got their heads together and gave chase with mud balls and screaming at poor little boys abused Master Robert. Old rail-splitting Abe's Bobby, a nigger's lover. Then they catched up with us and grabbed the cart in the rear and pulled back hard. I pulled as hard on the straps, and that mule seemed to have horse sense for once. She slowed down. I knowed my Billy and Master Robin weren't no match for that mess of heathens. They was the devil's own. My Billy would have gotten out of that cart quicker than a cat could catch a rat, but I grabs him by the seat of his pants while I was going over the end and hauled him back. Billy calls them white trash, an awful name. Quick as a flash, I give him a lick over his defiled, blaspheming mouth and note he'd been mixing around with them white trash on Jackson Street. I gives him another lick for good measure, and I warn him, if I ever catches him with any of them low-down white trash on Jackson Street, I'll give him worse blisters than Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego would have gone if God hadn't rescued them from the fiery furnace. But all that talk of mine to them young'uns went plumb through both their ears. I swear I hardly got my speech out of my mouth, and Billy howled, Mammy! Mammy! Here's Pappy's black snake whip. Give it to him. Them white trash was crawling in the back end of my cart. Just as I grabbed that black snake whip and crack it at him, God sent a terrible streak of lightning, a clap of thunder that most upset us, and the mule gives another lunge. We all screamed, and that mess of rascals done must have thought they were struck by that lightning. I swear a war horse couldn't have catched them. They sure didn't molest us no more. Oh, but when we done got to DeMissy, it was worse than all the messes I was ever in all my born days. There was DeMissy. Now, DeMissy here is Mary Todd. Laid up on the old black sofa, her feet twitching and kicking, her head covered with a quilt and spew or vomit all over the floor. I say to Master Robert, "Run for the doctor! Run, run, you scamps, run!" But then my Billy always snooping around say, "Mammy, Mammy, look at her. She ain't no need for the doctor. She's peeping. Her's playing possum, like Grandpappy's pet possum. Just get that black snake and give her a good wallop, and she'll forget all that blowing on outside, and it's going to blow this." As quick as lightning, those boys run out. I couldn't catch them. No siree. But before I uncovered her head or hold her feet from their jerking and twitching, back they come with that black snake whip. Billy come busting in the door screeching, "Wallop that lady, Mammy, and her'll stop scaring folks out of their wits." Master Robert looks scared. Poor, dear, sweet little Master Robert. That angel child has never been around any such as my Billy. Maybe I ought not to have done it, but I right there and then give Billy a cut with that black snake. He give a howl worse than the thunder. Up jumped DeMissy, her hair down and all tangled up, face covered with spew. There was no angel pretty about her now. I say, "Please, Missy, don't upset yourself. I've come to protect you. The storm is bound to be over soon. My Henry always say, the hotter the storm, the quicker it's over." But her wasn't jumping up about the storm. She was hair pulled mad because I wallops my Billy. She says to me, "Haven't you got nigger sense? Billy only told the truth. This is a hellhole, and I've made it so. If anyone needs to be beaten, I need it. But no one needs cruelty, and I won't lie still no matter how I feel and see it practiced in my house." Master Robert done run to his ma and cried, "Oh, ma, don't scold Mrs. Vance. She's a good understanding woman in her heart and head. I heard Paul tell her so." "Oh, yes, yes," said DeMissy. "It was good of her to come over here in this storm to be here to protect me, leave her home and family. I shouldn't have had you go for her, but I was so sick and afraid. Well, I just tell her she'd have to get more love in her heart, for my good book said, 'Love casts out fear.'" She says, "If love have cast out fear, Mariah, love will cast out whippings too." Well, I didn't want to argue with her, but my teaching never say anything about whippings. The storm, just as my Henry say, didn't last long. I got a basin of water for DeMissy to wash her face. I asked her if she would want as how I should clean up a clutter of parcels all about the floor. Do you know what she up and say? "Why, Mariah, those are little dresses I've made for your baby Julia from our darling little Eddie's clothes. I was so very sorry I disturbed baby Julia's sleep. I do so many wrong things when I have these headaches." "Well, yes," I say to her, "you're a very sick woman, but you shouldn't carry on with that baby you've got to have born. And bless your pretty heart, you didn't owe my black young'uns any dresses." We didn't see any strange woman soon enough, but there she stood right smack in the door. DeMissy speak right up to her, "Nice time for you to be coming, Liz." Then this Liz spied the spew in the carpet, and her acted all upset. She went over to DeMissy and say, "Mary, baby, why didn't Bobby tell me? Even though I've been swamped with work and must give a party, I would have dropped everything and come right over." DeMissy say, "Well, you know how afraid I am when it storms and Mr. Lincoln is away. All you think about is clean, clean, clean that big house and cook, cook, cook for parties." "Well, Mary," Liz says, "if you think less about sewing up all the goods in the country to outshine everyone else in dress, looking the material strewn around, and learn more about cooking and providing the right nourishing food for your family, you would have a happier and healthier family and home." DeMissy huffed up right smart about that. "Now, Lib," when she was mad, Mary called Liz Lib, if it's any of your nosy business, I'm just making a few little dresses for this fine colored woman's child." Lib right smart up and say, "Since when have you become so patronizing to colored folks? It's time you're thinking of someone besides yourself." "Well," say DeMissy with her hands on her hips and those pretty eyes turned into a cyclone, but still looking straight at this Lib like her ruled the earth, "Mariah came to me when you wouldn't. And you know, Lib, I wouldn't send for you or anyone else unless I needed them." This Missy sure have a world of spunk. Then her say in the sweetest voice ever in a human being, "This is my sister Elizabeth, Mariah. Mrs. Edwards, this is Mrs. Henry Vance. She came to help us out last Monday, Lib. She's a good, clean, honest woman." Right quick-like, Elizabeth spoke out, Mary, you need someone, and I hope you don't take any tantrums with this Mariah and run her off. I couldn't bear to hear that sick woman talk any more like that. So I say, with her fixed up like her is, she's a mad as sick woman with all her other complaints. I know, says Ms. Edwards, but there isn't anything wrong with her. The good common sense won't help some. Mother, father, and I have humored and spoiled her because she demanded it. And now her servants, Bobby and Mr. Lincoln especially, have to take the brunt of all our foolishness. Abraham takes it or gets out. Many times he gets out so Mary can have her way. I hope once in her life she has common sense enough to keep a good servant. All her other servants just couldn't take it, so they got out and stayed out. That was all sweet talk about me, but poor Missy, her spilled over a bucket of tears, crying her poor, poor sick heart out. Libs softened like Pappy's cotton balls, and as sure as God made little apples, her went over to Missy, kissed her, wiped up her tears with her silk handkerchief, and cried herself a little. Oh, I never once set eyes on such crying on, blazing mad at one minute, at one another one minute, and next minute loving and kissing like turtle doves. Maybe that's good raising. For I and my Henry, a little bit of fighting to get over it and seem powerful good. But two kin, I just can't see. Who ever thought that was even good sense? My pappy would have given us a learning we'd remember with his harness strap. There'd be no need for kissing and making up. We dasn't never fuss and fume on our home. I expect they better kiss and smooch first. Then there would be no fuming and fighting like wild cats. But for 10 years, I saw such doings, and they always parted friends and happy, like. Not with Mr. Abe. About the time he'd get his tank full of such foolishness, he'd just up and walk off, wait till the fire cool off. Not that I could always abide by that, but that there were a man, she says, a man of God. I just didn't like fuming around enough to take his own part, so there were no need to kiss and make up. And I'm going to stop there, and the story goes on. Did you find that interesting? Did you know that? I didn't. Look at all the stories in that book. Now, would you rather read a story like this, firsthand, authentic, or would you like to read a story written by a person who lived 100 years after the Lincolns and try to piece together historical things? You tell me. I know the answer. True stories are authentic. How many of you have ever read the word Red Fern Grows? Did you shed any tears? You did? How many of you cried? Wow, that's good. That's a made-up story. If you can cry when stories are made up, don't you feel even more like crying when stories are real, true stories? Why is story so powerful? We can identify with the characters. We gain insight into our own issues by observing a character in the story. This past year, I read the book to my students, Eyes of the Tailless Animal. Have you ever read that book? It comes from Voice of the Martyrs. That's one of the most awful books I've ever read. Some of the stuff I wouldn't even read to my students. That's a true story. And number 5 on here says we identify with the characters. There's almost nothing I can identify with in that book. Now, people act like Mrs. Lincoln sometimes. And whites and blacks still act like that a little bit today. Nobody ever says those words anymore. But there are some things we can identify with, and there are some things we can't identify with. But regardless, we recognize traces of humanity in stories, and we identify with those. Number 6, stories are powerful because they're easy to remember. We remember the emotions aroused within us by the story. How many of you have memories of your mother holding you or sitting beside you reading a story to you? Do you know what you felt like? Can you remember how you felt? Did you feel cozy and secure? Do you know what the stories were that she read to you? Okay, what stories did your mother read to you? Yeah, and she could read those stories and her arm was around you and it just did wonderful things for you, right? Yeah. I have stories that I remember my mother reading the Laurie Mills Wilder series. Just sit there, and mother reads those stories, and you get transported into another world, and you have feelings, not only for your mother, but you have feelings for the people in the story, and your imagination goes all kinds of places. It's just a wonderful experience for little children. But I was born in 1953, and when my mother finished that series of books, she got the Chronicles of Narnia. They were just new. C.S. Lewis had just written them. And she started reading those. And my little heart could not connect with those stories. And I was so turned off by the name C.S. Lewis that anytime I'd see it, I just was not interested. Until after I was married, I was working with a friend one day. We were putting hay or straw away. And this friend said, have you ever read C.S. Lewis's Screwtape Letters? No. And he suggested, I might want to look at them. So I did, and I could not believe what I was reading. I started reading just one chapter at a time. The insights were so powerful. I just, wow, where did this come from? Well, then that led me from one of his books to another. And today I very much appreciate the allegory that's involved with the Chronicles of Narnia. And I know there's some controversy about all that. I don't want to get in there. But at one point in my life, I could not connect. At another point, I could. To some stories. So we always want to deal with stories that people can connect with. If you read The Eyes of the Tailless Animals, you will get angry. Is it okay to get angry when you read a story? Is it okay to cry? Yeah. Is anger an emotion? Yeah. God says get angry, but then get over it too, right? Let not the sun go down in your wrath. If you can't get angry about something that's bad and wrong, then you're not worth very much either. Is it okay to make children angry when you read something? Facts? Yeah. When I read that book, I take the World Magazine, and I would bring pictures of Kim Il-sung. This is where it's going on. Go to the map and show where North Korea is. This is what it's like over there. And put that eyes of a tailless animal in a context of a real world. While we're sitting here, there are people over there on that side of the world experiencing this stuff. Powerful. Number 7, stories are shorthand experience. Learning by doing is never forgotten, but it's awfully expensive. Do you know what? The book of Proverbs says, learn and live. Learn first, and then live. Many times we operate the other way. Live and learn by hard experience. God knows better. He would like to prevent us learning from hard experience. And that's one of the major things we should be doing in our schools. Telling stories, educating these little children so they don't have to go by learn hard experience. They learn beforehand. And lastly, story is so powerful because it fills a basic human need. We have company. I'm not the only one to experience a difficult situation. On the first day here, Jonas told the story about jumping and showing off. Remember that story he told? That immediately kicked off something in my mind, because whenever I was a little boy, I did something similar. I connected. We were having a sewing circle at our house, and I decided that a good way to impress girls would be, you know, I was about 14 at this time, I should have known better, but I decided I'm going to climb a tree in our lawn. And there's this place right here. So I was up there in that tree, and of all things, one of the girls looked up there and she said, look at Chester up there showing off. She pricked my balloon. I crawled down. If I had been a monkey with a tail, my tail would have been between my legs the whole way down. So when Jonas told his story about that, it immediately clicked with me. I could identify. People know that stories are powerful ways to influence people. Right now, the homosexual agenda in our country is pushing. And they have books out there prepared to give little children in school so that they are conditioned to think in terms of homosexuality. One of the books that they're giving out there right now is the title, Sherry Has Two Mommies. Okay? You people have probably heard about the unfolding drama of Ken Miller's case going on right now. Do you know there's already a whole book written about that story? That's this one right here. Only One Mommy. But this book ends in 2009 when Lisa disappeared. This is just leading up to the case. Now, if you want some excitement and you want some stories, you might want to go to Burlington, Vermont next Tuesday and sit in on those things. In fact, I'll give you a phone number right now. They're asking that they don't want a whole bunch of people showing up one day and nobody the next day. So you call this number and they will help tell you when it's suitable to go. 540-490-2872. And you will reach Monroe Chuck with that number. 540-490-2872. For myself, I'm always looking for stories, especially stories you can experience that are authentic, firsthand, that you can tell your students. Sometime, I don't know how this is all going to unfold, when your grandparents, when this whole story is written, people read about it in the history book of Christ Heritage, you tell your grandchildren, I was there. I was in that courtroom. I listened to it. And your little grandchildren will say, wow, you shared in history that happened and unfolded. Other people know the power of story. Here's Susan Wise Bauer. She has The Story of the World, A History for the Classical Child. And she tells, that's volume four, History of the Modern Age. It's done with story. Here's another one. I listened to this on the way over here. The World Was Never the Same, Events That Changed History. 36 Events That Changed History by Rufus Fields. It's from the Great Courses. He often likes to use stories. For example, one of the things he said about the Battle of Gettysburg, at 3:06 on the afternoon of July 3rd. Then it was Pickett, or General Lee gave the command for Pickett to do his charge. That's the way he introduces things. Story is powerful. Even Faith Builders knows that. Do you ever hear of the living history strands, which go from grades 1 to 4? They're doing history by story. A child, a Christian child in our school who arrives at age 10 without a foundation of Bible stories is missing foundation stones in his life. All right. Let's go on to the second part of your... It says teacher storytelling. First thing there is that it's... let me say this first. Storytelling is entertainment, it's tension relief, it's drudgery relief, and it's respect building. Let me tell you a story. I taught in Texas for a number of years, and one of my students, former students, is sitting right here. She knows about it. If you don't believe me, ask her, Dolores Streit. Okay? So I go from Texas to Indiana into a brand new school. It's a whole different world from Texas to northern Indiana, and this school has some respect problems, and so... It sure helped that I had a little bit of white hair and some stories in my bag. Because I needed to find a footing, a way to deal with this. And so I told many stories, including this story and a bunch of others. Well, boys and girls who have respect problems, they do sit still and listen when there's a story. You know, many times boys and girls who are bored are cooking up stuff to do, right? But if you can keep them on the edge of their seat with stories, they don't have time to cook stuff up. And you actually stay ahead of them. And I found out that is a key to successful teaching. If you're always ahead of your students, we're going to talk more about this in the next class on routine of surprise. And one of the ways that, to do this is to tell stories. Now, here's a downside. I don't know. Maybe Dolores could tell us feedback on this one. But it does have a downside. I teach in a middle grade setting, 7, 8, and 9. Okay. I'm going to tell you a story right now, and I'm going to ask you a question afterwards. When I was in high school, public high school, never went to Christian school, every Friday or several Fridays a month, we used to have what we call General Assembly. And we'd go to the auditorium like this, and some kind of program was given. Well, one day, the program was a hypnotist. And he asked for volunteers from the audience, and several people went up to volunteer to be hypnotized. And they needed to have some volunteers to stand behind the people so that if they were hypnotized and they to slump down, that somebody puts them in a chair. So he went through all his hypnotizing stuff, and a number of people slumped. And so they're the ones that were subject to the hypnotism. So the one girl, she was given a tissue box with just regular tissues you blow your nose with. And the hypnotist told her, this is your second grade reading book. I would like you to read this page for me. And this is going to be hard for you to believe. But her voice turned into a second grader. Sally saw the cat run down the street. When she got to the end, and on, like a little second grader. Then she finally came to a word. What's this word? And he said, spell it. R-E-C-E-I-V-E. Receive. Receive. And then she went on reading again. Something that she could have done otherwise. Wow. Another boy, he hypnotized. He had a folding chair just like this. And he told this boy, he says, now you're not going to be able to get out of your seat. And we could see the boy sat on his chair like this. And then he says, all right, now get up. He could not stand up. And we could see his hands were there. Another boy, he hypnotized. They were on a stage like this. These people up here on the stage. He says, he gave him a make-believe fishing rod. He says, this is the water. Go fishing. So this boy stood on the edge of the stage, and he would throw his line in, roll it in like this, and throw it out again. But at the same time he was fishing, another girl he had hypnotized to be a nurse. And he told her that her beds were down here in front. And so she came down off the stage. These people have their eyes open. And they're down here, she was down here tending beds. But this boy fishing suddenly realized there's somebody in his water. So they started having an argument right in front of everybody. Get out of that water! I'm not in the water! You know, it's this argument going right in front of everybody. So the hypnotist had to separate them. Okay. I can't tell you too much here. He had, before he hypnotized him, said, when I give you a signal, you'll come out of this. So, when he got everybody back, and they were all standing up there again, he gave them the word, and suddenly they came to, and they were with us again. And we asked them later, what do you remember? They didn't remember any of it. Okay. Now, there's a whole lesson we could talk about hypnotism. That's not what I'm going to talk about. Now, if I'm telling that to a story at the class table, what about the poor people who are doing their homework? And this is where I pity Dolores. I don't know what to do about this. If you have a multi-grade setting, and stories are powerful, and they're effective, and you can use them to teach so well, what about the poor people who have homework to do? You can find out what Dolores did. I don't know. That's an unresolved problem. I don't know what to say about it. Okay, now look at your paper. It says, number one, age helps. Every passing year, there's more in the bag. Well, I'm 59, and my bag is has 59 years worth of stories. You're young yet, and your bag doesn't have many, but that's okay. You got to start somewhere. Dolores, I have more stories in my bag since I've been teaching after I taught you. Okay, I'm sorry you missed some stories. Okay, but get your bag open and get stories in there. And they can be stories you've read and or stories that you've experienced. Wide reading. Get your stories. I mean, I found this book, you know, and I just love this book, and I don't want to part with that book because it's so valuable, the stories that are in there. This book right here, this book. I read about this book, and when I had a chance to get this book, I got it regardless. You'll never be the same if you read this book, The Sunflower. The story is Simon Wiesenthal was 18 years old. He was a captive Jewish boy in like a concentration camp when Hitler's Germany was going on. And one day he was pulled out of line because a dying SS soldier wanted to talk with a Jewish boy. And so he went in. And this German SS soldier, his face is all bandaged. He was dying because a bomb had exploded nearby and ruined his eyesight, his face. And before he died, he wanted to confess his participation in his atrocities to a Jew and ask for forgiveness. He also said, "Would you take my remaining belongings here and give them to my mother?" And so when he told the story to this boy and he asked for forgiveness, the boy turned on his heel and left. Did not forgive him. That's one third of the book. The other two thirds of the book is Simon Wiesenthal asked, I think, about 56 people after that, did I do the right thing? The Jewish people he asked basically said yes. That boy could not extend forgiveness for dead people. You did the right thing. The Christian people he talked with said, no, you didn't do the right thing. But he talked to some other people too. So you have to read the whole book to find out. He took the man's belongings and went back to his mother, found his mother, gave the belongings, but he never told his mother the truth about her boy, because when her boy went into Nazism, she thought he was doing a wonderful and noble thing. Her boy was a noble-hearted boy, and he did not think his mother needed to ever know the truth. She went to her grave not knowing the truth. Did you know that this is, it's coming out that now recent research is actually telling the story that there were Mennonites in Germany, but they had already lost their non-resistance. This is a long story. I'm not going to tell you it all. Except that most Mennonites in Germany were silent participators in Nazism. There were a few who actually killed Jews. Maybe one brief story. There was a man by the name of Weens. He was the son of a wealthy Russian Mennonite farmer. And after he grew up on his own, he was a dairy inspector. But in 1931, he decided he's going to join the Nazi Party. You have to remember, Germany was trying to get out of the Depression. And Adolf Hitler represented a way out of the Depression, hope for the German people. And the Mennonites flocked to this idea, including this young man. He became a Nazi in 1931. By 1939, he had risen up through the ranks. He was a commander, a SS commander. And his job was to go out with a van to a village where he would gather all the Jews in the village, 800 to 1,000 of them, get them to register, and then told them, after that was all done, you go to a certain place with your personal belongings, you're going to be relocated on a certain day. So they arrived there with their belongings on that day. He also came with a special van, a gas van. He would ask the first 50, all right, take off your clothes, get in this van. So they would ride around in the van until all those people were gassed. He'd come over to a big grave that was already dug, tell some of those living Jews, pull those dead bodies out into this grave, get the next 50 in. And did that until all of them were killed. Then he would go to the next village and do the same thing. This is a former Mennonite. Now, the question is, why? There's a new book that's out called Mennonite German Soldier, which tells the story of what happened to these Danzig Mennonites as to how they lost their non-resistance in the space of 100 years, that they were willing to do things like that. Huge life lessons. Okay, moving on. There's an art to storytelling. Accurate details are less important. There's some drama that's appropriate, but develop it. You have to get started somewhere. So if you don't do so well the first time, just try it again and again and again, and it will work for you. Another thing to do is not to moralize. When you tell a story, don't say, the moral of this story is, okay, if you do that, you're treating them as children. Children are not stupid. They can get life lessons. Okay, number four says motivation. You can be in the midst of something, and if it doesn't suit to tell a story, you could say, remind me to tell you the story later. And believe me, they'll remember. I don't know if I'm going to get to it or not, but I'll just tell you right now. Look at number four under teacher repertoire, courtship stories. Now, some of you are not married yet, so you don't have this story in your bag. Courtship stories fascinate teenagers. And if you tell them something that you bump into in your text, remind me to tell you of when we were doing this in our courtship, they'll remember it. They want to hear a story like that. Okay, moving on. Number five, whenever subject matter reminds you of a story, tell it. And you bump into all kinds of situations like that. I'm going to have to tell you a story here. In science class, you study about sodium, right? Dolores knows this story. She's seen this one. All salt. You all eat salt, right? Tell me what salt's made of. Sodium and chloride. Okay, what's sodium all by itself? Chlorine's a deadly gas. If you smell it, you'll die, right? What's sodium? Okay, I decided I'm going to find out. So I sent money to one of these science supply companies and got a can about this big, and it's sealed in there. It's a piece of sodium. Sodium is a soft metal. You can cut it with a knife. It's like butter, but it's shiny. And so I got this. I took it up to my brother, and we're gonna work at this thing together. There was a science, in the Rotten Staff Science book, it tells you how to do a chemical reaction so you can collect hydrogen gas. And I couldn't understand why they have this big rigmarole. You have to dry it with calcium chloride and all that. But I thought, you know, they say sodium produces hydrogen directly. Why don't we just simply take a flask, put some water in, put a little sodium in, put a balloon right over top, and just collect the gas this way? Why not do it the easy way? So that's what we did. Took it up there, put the sodium in, started fizzing right away, put the balloon over top, and the balloon started blowing up like this. I thought, wow, this is amazing. Why did they tell us it? Bang! Scared me so bad, I knocked on the floor and broke it. Wow, this stuff is powerful. So we thought, the next thing we do, we better not try a flask anymore. So we got a 5-gallon bucket, you know, a white bucket about this big around, this tall. So we took another chunk off it off and put it in the 5-gallon bucket, and we just threw it over top of it, looking like this. Woo! You know, when sodium hits water, it burns. It actually turns on fire. One time, whenever we did on a rainy day, gotta stop, gotta tell you this story first, is in there dancing around in the water and doing its fizzing and burning and poof, like that. Something flew up and hit me right here in the lip. And whenever sodium is in water, it also makes sodium hydroxide, which is lye, and some of it hit me right here in the lip. Burn a hole right in my lip. Whoa. That could have gone in my eyes. I was so stupid, I didn't even have goggles on. Whew, this stuff is powerful. So one day, I was doing, I think it was before I was ever in Texas yet, I did this to a school in Pennsylvania. On a rainy day, all you got to do is put sodium in a bucket like that with about that much water in the bottom, and you will have fireworks. This stuff, poof, like this. And every place it landed, it started burning because it was wet. As soon as it hits water, it burns. I did this in northern Indiana, too. It's like everybody's like, oh, we never saw anything like this. After you see things like that, you never forget what sodium is, ever. Okay. Number 8 says story time must not be dropped with a tight schedule. You ever think about, oh, I got to get all this science and history done, English. So we'll drop story today. Mistake. Story is more important. Sorry. Even for upper graders. Number 9, you learn to know students in spite of themselves. And this is fun. Because whenever you read a story, you get to look at them and how they're responding, okay? I work with students that they don't want me. They're a young teenager, and they don't want me to see inside them, okay? I remember reading Uncle Tom's Cabin to some students, and there was a girl in the class that, in spite of herself, her mouth dropped open, and she couldn't imagine how human beings relate to other human beings like that. I won't forget that. She told me things about herself that she didn't know. I've never even told her that I saw that. Okay, let's hasten on here. The teacher repertoire. I told you I have 59 years of stories in my bag. It's okay if you have less, but just get them. Number 2, wide reading. This is why, one of the reasons you ought to be reading books. So you have stories to tell. Not just reading story books, but just read books and you will get stories. Moving on, number 3, travel, visit, explore off the beaten track. I have a son in Ireland right now, and so just this past year, the summer, just a few weeks ago, I was over in Ireland walking around visiting places and England, and I came back with a bunch of stories in my bag. One of the stories you're going to hear about in the next class, the split session, if you're in that, I'll just save that for right now. You've heard about the British Museum. You get your history books and have pictures from the British Museum. But what happens if you get a chance to go into the British Museum? One of the things I wanted to see is all the mummies in the British Museum. And you get in there and there's all kinds of mummies in there. Some mummies are completely unwrapped. Some mummies that have the sarcophagus apart. You can see the mummy in between. And they actually have a mummy that's unwrapped. You know, they took the organs out. And they put them in these canoptic jars. They have some of those there. But they have a mummy unwrapped and a hole in the side where you could see where they pulled all this stuff out. And you could see mummies that, like somebody had an abscess in their tooth and the bone is rotted away. Or you can see a mummy that has the person who had it had arthritis. Their bones are kind of the way arthritic bones get. This is all real stuff. Plus a whole lot more. One of my co-teachers, not this past summer, but the summer before, just simply went on a mercy ship. What do you think she had when she came back? She had pictures and stories. You know, one of the jobs of a teacher is to enlarge student horizons. And I'll just tell you this. I found out that if you live in a settled Anabaptist community, your horizons are about this big. And the job of a teacher is to expand those horizons. And you do that with stories. If you live in an outlying community, you can't live there. Your horizons have to get big. And so it's especially important. If you work in a settled community, get those stories in there. Get that horizon big. I found out that some people don't want to have their horizons stretched. It's safe. We know what's going on here. We don't like all this horizon stretching stuff. Sorry. That's the job of a school, to introduce students to new things. Make them think in new ways. Force them to get out of their feelings of protection and safety. Get out into the real world. That's a major job of a teacher. Okay, I already talked to you about the courtship stories. I'm running out of time here, but if you really want to know one of my courtship stories, I have a long story. I think Dolores heard all this. So, I married a girl, and I didn't know how sensitive she was to motion sickness. And believe it or not, I took her out on the Atlantic Ocean for a fishing trip. That's all I'll say about that right now. Okay, number 5, geography calls for stories. Okay, I'm living in Indiana. I lived in Texas for many years. And just recently I was in Carlisle. I cannot come back to my hometown without thinking of the story of Regina and the German captives. You know that story? How the French and Indian War, as a result of the English winning, they asked the Indians to give up all their white captives. And Colonel Bouquet brought them back to Carlisle, Pennsylvania, on the square that's there today, and asked the white people to come to Carlisle and to find their missing children. And the story there was a lady who came to find her daughter and could not find her. She went up and down these rows of children, looking, couldn't find it. Finally, Colonel Bouquet said, well, is there any songs you used to sing to your children? And so she started singing a song as she walked by. And suddenly, one of these tall Indian girls started crying and ran to her. And the song that she sang was, "Alone, but yet not alone." That's how she found her daughter. You found that in some of your reading books, probably. That happened in my hometown. The Paxton boys, you can't be a Mennonite and not know that story. I was in Stephen Russell's class the other day here. He's talking about Mennonites and Revolution. And of all things, that's a hugely important story. And just past summer, we had my wife's a Souder, and we had a Souder family gathering. And this man took us out to the Souder family graveyard. Inside a wall, has all kinds of Souder stones there. Great. Only to learn that that particular cemetery is on the grandfather's farm of one of the Souder boys who married one of those Martin girls. It's on their farm now. It's, whoa. And even more significant, just up the road, just like a field or two away, is where this Paxtang massacre happened. Wow. I tell that story every time I teach Anabaptist history. Any of you in my Clan Baptist history class at Calvary Bible School? Okay. It's so impressive. And now I have that to add to my story. Okay, people call for stories. Family background. I gotta tell you one story. This really truly happened to my uncle. My uncle was kind of an interesting fellow. He just died recently. But anyway, he used to work with the mission in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And I could say his real name because I think it's safe here. His name was Jehu. And Jehu was from South Carolina. And he would come out to my uncle's place. And one day he was there. And this Jehu discovered that my mother was baking cookies that day. Now this is, when I was a boy, we lived at another place. Okay? Here's where my home was, and here was a cemetery right here, and this is where my uncle lived. And so my uncle told Jehu, who knew that my mother was baking cookies, now you're not allowed to go up there and get any cookies. But Jehu decided he's going to go anyway because he liked cookies. So he goes up here and gets some cookies. Well, somehow my uncle discovered he was gone. He called my mother up, and he said, "Was Jehu there?" She says, "Yes." So here's what my uncle did. Jehu was extremely superstitious, and he did not like to walk past the graveyard. But by the time he was coming back, it was dark. And so my uncle, whenever Jehu came down, walking down here, quivering and shaking as a result of having walked past this graveyard, when he walked in the door, my uncle just reached out and grabbed his ankles. Like this. And he thought the ghost got him. He just ripped off the door, ran down the driveway. And when my uncle got to him, he had fallen into the ditch. He was still running and kicking in the ditch yet. He was trying to get away. You might say my uncle was mean. I don't know. Personal stories are best. The teacher is human and so are the students. This is the last story that I'm going to quit. I went to public school in grade 2. Our teacher wanted us to do a dance. We're gonna have a PTA meeting or something. We're gonna do a dance. Well, my mother found out about this, and she wrote a little letter to the teacher explaining why her son should be excused from the dance. Well, I wanted to participate in this, so I took the letter that my mother wrote to the teacher. I read it. I didn't like it, so I went up into the attic, and tore it into little tiny pieces about a quarter inch wide, so nobody would ever be able to put it together. And there's a distance between the weatherboarding on the outside and the inside stuccoed walls up in the attic, and I dropped those pieces of paper down that hole. And they're probably there to this day if we tear the house down and find them. But my mother came to this meeting, PTA, and there was her little boy up on the stage doing the bunny hop with everybody else. I just asked my mother about that the other day, how she felt. Well, you can imagine how she felt. Okay, I told my students that just the other, I think this past year. They love to hear that. Here's this old strict teacher who tells them to behave, and he's up there doing a bunny hop. And so they say, would you tell us, would you show us how you did the bunny hop? I drew the line there. I would not show them how to do the bunny hop. Okay, I got to quit. We have, I don't know how many stories sitting in this room right now. Your life is a story. If Christ tarries, your children are going to read your story and the story we're writing collectively. And we get to be the characters. All the other stories, other people are the characters, right? Now we're going to be the characters. So what lessons are people going to learn from us? Thank you for your attention.
For more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit thedocforlearning.org.